Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Good morning. Indeed, today is the day. Good morning. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thank you for taking me along or including me in whatever morning process you are currently engaged in today. I am reminded that there are folks who are listening right now who, you know, we're sharing time brushing teeth and getting coffee and getting school, getting kids out of bed and off to school. So as you enter into your day, thanks for taking us with you here at Faith Radio. Let me open with some verses from Psalm 16. The Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. And then verse 11, one of my favorites. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. As we bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day, as we enter into this Friday, March the 1st, as we enter into a new month, as we enter into a new day, as we enter into the conversations of this day as the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven amidst the kingdoms of this world, let us make known to others the path of life we know in Jesus Christ. Let us be people who give bodily and verbal demonstration and witness to the fact that we live in the presence of the living God. And in that, there's fullness of joy. So let's bring the joy of the Lord to bear on life today. And let's remember that in God's presence, we not only find deep peace and great pleasure, but the fullness of joy. So leading off today, my friend Mark Tooley from the Institute for Religion and Democracy is going to be here to talk with us not only about what happened at the United Methodist General Council, but wow, all the fallout from it. Lots of reactions and responses to what happened in St. Louis at that international meeting or that global meeting of the United Methodist Church and its implications for United Methodists right here in the United States. That's up first here on Mornings with Carmen. Mark Tooley, you've been my friend a long time. You are the president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C. But in 1994, you actually started the United Methodist Action component of the IRD. So you've been at this a long time. When we talk about United Methodism, we're talking about your denomination. We're talking about the church you call home. So this is intensely personal. So thank you for joining us today on Mornings with Carmen.
Hey, Carmen, great to be with you.
So for folks who may not have been paying as close attention to the news this week and last week as others, briefly tell us what happened in St. Louis at the General Council of the United Methodist Church. Yeah, let's just start with that. What actually happened?
Well, this was the top governing body of the global United Methodist denomination with over 12.5 million members, and it resolved to reaffirm its current biblical teachings about marriage and sexuality, and not only to reaffirm them, but to strengthen the enforcement and accountability procedures around them, in that there are clergy and bishops in America who have been defying church law regarding the church's definition of marriage and sexual ethics.
So I shared with folks yesterday that this is really historic in terms of what's been going on, or the trend here in the United States of America related to this topic among mainline denominations. And we kind of rehearsed for our listeners where other denominations have gone, and how really unique and distinctive it is for the United Methodist Church to have taken this action to reaffirm what we would consider to be biblical, traditional, or, you know, Christian definitions, not only of sexuality, but of marriage. And you used a word in describing the event, and you used the word global. Why is that significant in this conversation?
Yes, United Methodism is pretty unique among the historically liberal mainline denominations in that it has not surrendered on its definition of marriage, but it's also unique, and this explains why it's unique in the other way, because it is a global denomination, and almost half of its members are outside the U.S., mostly in Africa. So there are 6.8 million members in the U.S., but there are 5.3 in climbing in Africa, where, of course, Methodism is very conservative, and the African delegates voted uniformly against any liberalization of the definition of marriage.
So I will tell you, Mark, that, you know, as somewhat of an outsider, but a person who certainly likes to pay attention and watch what's happening, the pictures, the visual footage of, frankly, older white Americans seeking to school young, dark-skinned brothers and sisters in Christ, as if they are somehow, you know, not quite as up to speed on things, and therefore, you know, they're behind the times, and that's why they hold these views. Can you help us understand that there's actually a lot of people in the United Methodist Church here in the United States who join with, who are still in absolute agreement with the global church on this issue of sexuality and marriage?
Yes, it was a collaboration and alliance between evangelicals in the U.S. church and the African delegates, and most of the delegates from the Philippines, and many of the delegates from Europe, especially Eastern Europe and Russia. And so it was a very global coalition reaffirming traditional Christian standards on marriage and sexual ethics. And it's very perplexing and exasperating to American liberals in the church who just assume that Methodists would follow the other mainline churches inevitably, and who do not know how to make a case to Methodists overseas, and who, of course, have had for decades a very disdainful attitude towards evangelicals in the American church. And of course, although they try to hide it, very often are disdainful towards the overseas churches, including the Africans.
So Mark, and again, we're talking with Mark Tooley from the Institute for Religion and Democracy. You can follow him on Twitter at Mark D. Tooley, or the IRD at the IRD. Mark, let's talk about how people are responding, because it has not been universal agreement. Folks have not necessarily all been coming forward and saying, oh, well, clearly the mind of Christ has been discerned on this matter, and we will now all joyfully submit to the discernment of the Spirit by the church in these things. That's actually not what we're reading in the headlines. So tell us how folks have been responding.
Well, of course, liberals in the church and liberals outside the church have responded with great alarm. Liberals in the church, of course, are shocked and distressed, finally realizing that they probably can never win, and that demography of the denomination is now stacked against them. But many outside the church are astonished that there is a mainline church that has now said no to any compromise on the Christian understanding of marriage, which of course to them seems very retrograde, but of course this is the reality of global Christianity as opposed to declining liberal Protestantism in America and in the West.
So let's take 2 minutes to get caught up on what's happening in your local community with your local news this morning, and then Mark Tooley and I will be right here to continue this conversation about what's happening in the United Methodist Church and how we, as Christian brothers and sisters, can now prayerfully support them as they move forward. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge. So continuing my conversation with Mark Tooley from the Institute for Religion and Democracy, we call it the IRD. He is tweeting at Mark D. Tooley. You can find the IRD at the IRD or obviously online. And so, Mark, let me ask this question. So as I'm sort of scrolling through the headlines of the day related to the topic of the decision by United Methodists, I get headlines like this in the Tampa Bay Times. Tampa Bay United Methodist clergy vowed to defy church's LGBTQ bans. International vote roils United Methodist Church and draws strong response from local clergy. They're not the only ones. We got Adam Hamilton. You know, he was like fast out of the gate in terms of having his press release ready. We have heard from the titular head of the United Methodist Church's, you know, lobbying efforts in Washington, D.C. I mean, we've heard from folks who they think they are right. They believe that LGBTQ affirmation is the right way forward. They obviously view the decision by the United Methodist General Council as wrong and errant. And it does not seem as if they are going to joyfully submit to the authority of the church on these issues. So what happens for those of us who are not, you know, in United Methodism? What happens? How is discipline exercised in the United Methodist Church? Because, you know, from my experience in the PCUSA, we were absolutely unable to bring people into conformity with the church's decision making when we did require fidelity in marriage and chastity and singleness for those in offices of leadership. So how does your polity help you right now?
Well, church law requires that charges be filed against clergy who profess to be actively sexual outside of male-female marriage, or who conduct or facilitate same-sex marriages. But as you note, in the most liberal regions of the church, in the West and some places of the Northeast, church law is mostly ignored because the bishops are very liberal and look the other way. But in most areas of the U.S. church, the church law is upheld, and the latest legislation will tighten church law in the area of sexuality. So the other side can talk big, and in some cases they will defy church law. But the next General Conference in 2020 will certainly reaffirm what this General Conference did and probably tighten it further and perhaps take action against the bishop elected by the Western jurisdiction in 2016, who is herself openly lesbian and, of course, in defiance of church law.
So one of the things that you and I know about the church is that, you know, unlike civil government, when a law is passed by a civil government, there is then law enforcement. You know, there's like, you know, the police. We don't really have that right in the church. We actually expect people to joyfully submit to the authority of Scripture, to joyfully submit to the authority of a particular denomination if they express to be a part of that. And so I think that from my perspective, you know, one of the great challenges is you win at the quote unquote legislative level of your church. You will win in your church courts. I mean, I don't mean you, but I mean the position that you advocate. And still there will be people, because of the way American culture is trending right now, and because the media will continue to give liberals and progressives a platform in these conversations because they tend to advantage them, frankly. This is hard. And so how can we be praying for you and for others who continue to labor on this particular front in United Methodism?
Well, thank you. Certainly, we welcome your prayers for all who have worked for and continue to work for renewal and accountability in the United Methodist Church, but also in terms of a final resolution for this issue. To the extent there is one, there needs to be a new liberal Methodist denomination created to which these congregations and individuals who cannot abide church policy on marriage and Christian sexual morality, they cannot find satisfaction in the United Methodist Church, whose standards are not going to change. And perhaps for the first time, liberals are now openly discussing the possibility of creating something new for them outside the United Methodist Church. And I think that is the ultimate solution.
So as a person who, who has been a part of this conversation for a long time and has yet to see a denomination joyfully allow people to depart peaceably, particularly with their property, this is actually, I think the growing edge, not only of conversation in United Methodism, for which we need to be praying, but for those of us who have walked this journey in other denominations, we would absolutely celebrate the creation of some gracious separation method, so that United Methodists are not rent asunder in the same way that Episcopalians and Presbyterians and Lutherans and the UCC, nobody really let anybody leave peaceably, particularly with their property. And so if liberals and progressives were allowed to leave peaceably without creating, what we would consider, there is a theological schism. It already exists. And so and so now it's the details of how each party goes forward. And so, Mark, I want to assure you of our prayers. And I want to assure you that those of us in the larger family of faith who are with you and the global church on these issues, we're committed to continuing not only to follow this story, but to be with you in this journey.
Thank you, Carmen. You're a dear friend, and you understand our struggles because you've been through them yourself. But hopefully we are going to have a different conclusion in Methodism than you all unfortunately had in the old Presbyterian Church USA. So I'm looking forward to good things ahead, but there are also plenty of battles ahead too.
Absolutely. So Mark, let's conclude with this, because I know you're a joyful United Methodist. Tell people why you are a United Methodist and why United Methodism is a great place to grow as a disciple of Jesus Christ.
Oh, it's a great place. I'm a lifelong Methodist and grew up in the church. I came to faith in Christ in the church in a average but also wonderful congregation. And it's full of people committed to the gospel. And I have to say, some of the most important and meaningful friendships of my life have been those with whom I have collaborated or working for the renewal of the church. People I would never have otherwise have gotten to know had our church not had these controversies and these battles. So I think the Lord has been in those battles.
Absolutely. Mark Tooley from the Institute for Religion and Democracy. You can check out what they are doing online at theirdami.com or .org, since I don't have it up in front of me.
We are a .org.
theird.org. You can also follow Mark on Twitter at Mark D. Tooley. My friend, thanks so much for being with us this morning on Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you, Carmen.
Let's take a minute to lighten up. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. So I live in Middle Tennessee, and one of the streets that I pass to and from my house every single day is called Chigger Ridge. And Paul Perot has just described chiggers as the insect version of the piranha. So when you think about spring coming and summer coming, and you hear people say things like don't wear shorts in the tall grass, I think it's an opportunity for us as Christians to talk about all of the invisible threats that are out there all the time. seeking to, you know, frankly, eat away at us, not only irritate us, but cause us real harm. And the protections, the layers of protection that we need to put on, even if those layers of protection are inconvenient. So let me encourage you today to put on Christ and don't let your Christianity just be a put on, right? Put on the full armor of God before you head out into the world as an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven, as a minister of reconciliation, because, you know, frankly, the world is full of spiritual chiggers. All right, we got to take a little time here for the news. And then we are going to talk about Amazon and conversations related to New York. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge.
It's encouragement and hope for your daily journey.
It is a joy to contribute. We're glad to participate, knowing that the station continues to get better and better. It goes farther and farther, and we're just getting the good news out. So that's one of the major donations that we like to make, and we like to encourage people to do the same thing.
We get far more out of it than we'd ever be able to put into it, I can assure you that.
Thanks for being part of the family of Faith Radio.
Hey there, this is Pastor J.D. Greer, your teacher for the daily radio broadcast Summit Life. Are you right now living a life of unquenchable joy, reckless generosity, or audacious faith? Well, I would like to invite you personally to join me every single weekday on Summit Life right here and discover how to live out that abundant life that only Jesus Christ provides.
Listen for Summit Life weekday mornings at 11:30 here on Faith Radio.
Your need. He knows what to do, and he knows when to do it. This is Jim Garlow. God plans and orchestrates things with remarkable precision. This is a spiritual axiom. It's always true. And his plans concerning the Messiah were laid out in the Old Testament long before the Lord's coming in the flesh. 2 Timothy 3:16 reminds us that all Scripture is God-breathed. We shouldn't be surprised then that the feast of the Lord, such as the Passover, correspond to exact moments in time. The spotless lamb of that feast was a foreshadowing of Jesus, so it follows he was crucified at the same time the Jewish people had observed the Passover for nearly 1,500 years. When you find yourself impatient for a prayer to be answered, repeat again. Jesus knows your need, he knows what to do, and he knows when to do it. I'm Jim Garlow.
All right, so I'm on my second cup of coffee this morning. I hope that you are moving into your day intentionally as well. I hope you started with scripture, some time in the Word of God before anything else. I find that it not only prepares me for the conversations of the day, but it frankly steadies my soul. So let me encourage you in that as well today. So the process of Amazon, which, you know, this behemoth of a company, frankly. So Amazon, we all know, at least in theory, who they are and what they do, because we go to Amazon and they send us things, and we're members of Amazon Prime and they send us things. But Amazon is actually a constellation of all kinds of economic efforts. They are an online retailer. They're also a technology company. So in the process of choosing a second location for their headquarters, you will remember that they initiated a process a couple of years ago, actually. In late 2017, they announced that they wanted to build a new headquarters, and they announced that it would house 50,000 workers, that they would spend $5 billion on new construction. And then they initiated what I would describe as a process that was a lot like how the Olympics chooses a city. And so cities across America actually actively competed. They came up with all kinds of ideas, and they tried to describe their cities in ways that would be attractive, not only to Amazon in terms of its culture as a company, but attractive to Amazon in terms of its bottom line. This is actually the way that economic development efforts like this work across the country. Like, different communities actually compete. This is actually why companies move from one state to another. If you, I feel like Remington is in the process of moving from New York to a state that, frankly, is not quite as anti-gun and hostile to the Second Amendment as the state of New York. I know that there are lots of individuals who are leaving tax-heavy states like California and New York in order to move to states where the tax burden is not as great. Okay, so corporations, they do that same sort of calculation, the same calculus that you and I do about where we're going to retire, right? Because we want to, or where we're going to live the last few years before retirement. I mean, frankly, if you've never had this conversation with a person who has some, you know, some substantial wealth, like, this is an interesting conversation. If you have wondered why, just prior to retirement, in the years leading up to retirement, people who know that they are going to, you know, benefit from their years of labor in ways that are particularly economic, maybe they're going to sell a business, they move to states like Florida or Texas, where the tax burden is different, where the taxes, where the tax codes are different than they are in tax heavy states like New York and California. So I thought it would be fun today to have this conversation with a person who can probably speak to the issues in a way far more intelligently than I can. And so that that individual is Hugh Welchel. So Hugh, you are working with the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, tweeting at Faith Work Econ. Welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you. It's great to be with you guys.
It's so great to have you. So yesterday, you and I were going to talk about, you know, a different angle on this. This morning, we get up and we read in the New York Times and now in the USA Today and across other media outlets. And we just heard in the news at the top of this hour, we now have a letter signed by 40 CEOs, including the heads of some of the largest corporations based in New York. It's signed by politicians and members of Congress, the presidents of New York University, the United Federation of Labor. They are asking Amazon to reconsider coming to, Long Island City, Queens, the Queens area of New York. Please, please, please come and build HQ2 here. For those who have not been following this story, tell us what's going on with Amazon and New York.
Yeah, it was interesting. Obviously, Amazon had this big thing where they asked cities all over the United States to submit proposals, and they were going to decide to build two headquarters. And finally, after what seemed to be almost like a TV show with all these different candidates vying for the grand prize, they finally awarded New York City and Washington, D.C., as the two places where they're going to build their two, quote, Eastern headquarters, unquote. And what happened in New York is, and this may be a little oversimplification, but I think a number of politicians who saw an opportunity to make a name for themselves by opposing the money that New York was giving, and really it's not money per se, it's tax credits, for New York to come there. So New York promised Amazon almost just a little short of $3 billion worth of tax incentives to move their headquarters. Now, this seems like a lot, but New Jersey actually offered them $5 billion of tax incentives to move to New Jersey, which obviously they turned down. Interesting enough, Virginia only offered about $750 million worth of tax incentives. Now, interesting enough, Virginia is a much nicer place, in a lot of people's opinion, particularly economically, to move because the taxes are much less. The cost of living is somewhat less, not a whole lot less. So it's interesting that it's not just about the money, but some of these politicians saw an opportunity, like I said, to really, I think, make a name for themselves. And they used this and they wrote a lot about it. And then Amazon says, well, if you guys don't want us, we won't come. And it's caused quite a backlash because this was really, really a good deal for New York, which is why you see so many of these important, thoughtful people writing to ask Amazon to reconsider. One of the problems, I think, when you have these kind of deals, and this is nothing new, these kind of sweetheart deals being done by cities and states have been going on for many years. I mean, the classic example that really gets in the news most of the time is the football stadium that wants to be built for a professional team in a town, and the town puts up all the money. And then what typically happens, and I think this is where people have kind of a negative view of this type of thing, is when it's proposed and when the city gives all the money to help build the stadium, there are all these ideas that, oh, we're going to get a lot of money in return, there's going to be lots more jobs, and those things don't pan out. And so typically these things are losers for the cities or states are involved. And what's happened, I think, cities and states have gotten much more sensitive to this. And as a result, they're cutting much better deals. This is really, really a good deal for the for New York City for a number of reasons.
So I live in Nashville. And obviously, we were like, you know, third, but we're thrilled. We're people here are excited that 5,000 new jobs are going to come to the city of Nashville at the Operations Center of Excellence that Amazon intends to build here. There's a buzz about it that's very positive. And so, I have a perspective on this that maybe other people in other communities don't share. But here in, you know, here in Middle Tennessee, we actually think jobs are good, and people who want jobs, we want them to have jobs. And so I'll just admit to you, Hugh, I found the whole thing kind of hard to understand that a politician from a neighboring congressional district would not want good paying, high quality jobs. And then all of the concentric ripple effects of economic development that come from that. Out of fear, I think, fear that some local residents would then be displaced because housing values would rise. So I need some help understanding the mindset that doesn't want 25,000 high paying jobs and economic development in the neighborhood next to you. Why would we not want that?
Yeah, I have to agree with you 100%. And once again, I think it was politicians that were doing things that really were serving their own interests, not the city's interest, that really kind of ginned up the opposition toward this. I mean, if you just take just some simple on the back of a napkin figures, you figure they offered them $3 billion in incentives. If you run the numbers, that's about $5,000 a job over a 10-year period, right? If you look at, these are going to be $100,000 plus salaries. If you look at the tax rate, which is a little over 8% in New York, 8% of $100,000, that more than covers the tax incentives. And that does not include the $5 billion worth of job training over the next 10 years that Amazon promised to do for the whole city. All the improvements that are going to take place in this particular area where they had planned to build their facility. And once again, like I said, the incredible ripple effects that it has on the economy. One of the things that people often throw up is this idea it's going to raise housing prices. And we heard people say that here in the Northern Virginia area because housing prices continue to rise here as well. But it's really kind of a red herring in a lot of ways, because if you look at, let's take Virginia, because I know a little bit more about the demographics here, because this is where I live in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. This area created over 100,000 jobs in the last 5 years. So to add 25,000 more jobs over a 10-year period is just a drop in the bucket. It's not going to have any effect at all on housing prices. The same thing is true in New York, if not even more so. And I think people take some of these things, inflate them because they sound bad, but the reality is it has no impact. And I think what you're seeing with this letter that you referenced when we first began this conversation is that people who know what's going on, who don't have, you know, any kind of self-motivated thing where they're trying to make a name for themselves and trying to get elected to a bigger office, perhaps. These are level-headed people who have the best interest of their community in mind. And I think what you're seeing is this kind of drawback from these initial statements by just a handful of politicians kind of ginned up this resistance movement that kind of surprised Amazon, I think. And it's interesting how this is going to play out. So we'll have to see.
You're listening to Mornings with Carmen here on Faith Radio. Hugh Welchel and I are talking not only about Amazon, but we're going to talk next up about the relationship between work and faith and human dignity. So go grab another cup of coffee. That is just ahead.
Nothing to do to save his life, call his wife and...
So every time I hear Ravi tell that story about, folks in prison acknowledging that if we had more Bibles in our high schools, we would need fewer Bibles in our prisons because there would frankly be fewer people in prison. I am reminded of efforts across the country to have Bible courses actually offered in our public high schools. And so let me encourage you to be mindful of those efforts across the country. BibleInTheSchools.com is one place you can go. BibleInSchools.net is another one. That's the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools. So there are efforts all around the country related to this. There's Bible distribution in public schools, and it's all legal. So let me encourage you, if you are a person with whom that issue resonates, you can actively engage. Hey, Hugh, you work with the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, tweeting at Faith Work Econ. Can we talk about the relationship between work and faith and human dignity?
Yes, it's something that we write about and really talk about quite a bit at the Institute. And I think it's incredibly important, and it's been lost by Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity, in the last century.
So what's the connection? Like when we think about work as Christians, how should we think about work?
That's a great question. I think one of the things we have to do is go back and understand that God created us to work. If you look in Genesis 2:15, this is before the fall, early in creation, he says he put Adam in the garden to work it and to take care of it. One of my favorite verses in that opening passage of Genesis about creation Genesis 27 and 28, basically what God does, Adam and Eve have been created. They've been put in the garden. God comes to them and says, let me tell you what your job description is. Let me tell you why I made you. This is why I created you. I want you to do two things. I want you first to fill the earth with my images. And second, I want you to subdue the earth. Now, that word subdue is literally the Hebrew word kibosh. And in that context, it means to go make the earth an incredible place for human beings to flourish. So that's what you're here to do. Fill the earth with images and make those images flourish. And I think that is really what our work is all about. And we've kind of lost sight of that. We think our work is a means to an end to pay the bills, to try to get enough money set aside so we can retire someday. But that's not it at all. The purpose of our work, the godly purpose of our work, the reason we were put here is to fill the earth with images and to make the world an incredible place for human beings to flourish. Now, think about that image thing a little bit. Because of the fall, we have to change that a little bit. Our job today is to fill the earth with redeemed images. You see, that's church. That's evangelism. That's discipleship. And the church has done a pretty good job at that. It's the other half we've completely forgotten. This idea that the work of our hands is to make this planet an incredible place for those images to flourish. That's just as important as the first one. And yet we've kind of forgotten it. Now, interesting, if you go back and look at the history of the church, you look at Western civilization over the last 2,000 years, believers, through the ages have understood this and have used the talents and the resources that God has given them to make the world a better place. They've created hospitals. They created educational centers, educated people, schools, great art, great music. Christians were at the forefront of abolishing slavery. You make a list, almost every good thing that's been done in Western civilization over the last 2,000 years, with the exception of the last 100 years, where we as Christians have forgotten this, it's been believers using the gifts God's given them through their work to make the world a better place. We've got to get people back to that.
So you and I should continue this particular conversation in the weeks to come, because I think this is such an encouragement to people. And I think that it is something that we don't talk about often enough. Work is not just toil, right? Work is actually what we are, what we're designed and called to do. And it can be beautiful. And so in every way that you are out there in the world today working, I want you to do your work as unto the Lord. Let's start with that. And then let's each be thinking about, how could I labor today in such a way? How could I work today in such a way that I am actively participating in God's great and good design to make the earth an incredible place where God's image bearers can actually flourish? What would it look like for me to do my work today, whatever my work is, whatever is before me to do? What would it look like for me to do that work in such a way that I'm actually revealing who God is, and I am literally making the world a better place? So, Hugh, let's continue that conversation in the weeks to come. It's Hugh Welchel from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, tweeting at FaithWorkEcon. Hugh, thanks for being with us today on Mornings with Carmen.
You're welcome. I look forward to our next conversation.
Yeah, me too. All right, I gotta take just a 1 minute break here, and then we'll be right back. So I don't have you and I are just gonna have to acknowledge that. Wow, I completely ran out of time in this portion, and so you're listening to Mornings with Carmen here on Faith Radio. And we're going to grab a cup of coffee and reconvene right here in literally a minute from now. And just to let you know, you can always share today's show with somebody. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at MyFaithRadio.com.